Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC in New York, this is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. If you know the song Feeling Good, you might not associate it with the old English actor Anthony Newley, but Newley actually co-wrote the song with his songwriting partner Leslie Bricusse. The reason you might not associate the song with its creators is because someone else came along, recorded the tune, and made it entirely her own.
Fish in the sea, you know how I feel. River running free, you know how I feel. Blossom on the tree, you know how I feel. It's a new dawn, it's a new day, it's a new life for me, and I'm feeling good.
The great Nina Simone. Once she got her hands and her voice on Feeling Good, it basically became a Nina Simone song. You know, she wasn't just a thrilling musician. She was a commanding presence on and off the stage, and that really set her apart from other singers of the mid-1960s. Nina Simone blazed a trail that others are still following. For example, last week at the South by Southwest Festival in Austin, Texas, the R&B singer Khalees unveiled a version of this Nina Simone song at the NPR Music Showcase.
Fish in the sea, you know how I feel. River running free, you know how I feel. Blossom on the tree, you know how I feel.
Her set basically paid tribute to Nina Simone, and you'll hear some of Khalees's live performance coming up in a few minutes. We'll also take a look at Nina Simone's own career from the perspective of the civil rights struggle. But to begin, there's another struggle for women's rights, or at least a kind of gender equality beginning to take shape, and the battleground, surprisingly, is the world of music videos.
I love you, puppy. I love you, love you, love you, puppy. I love you, puppy. I love you, love you, love you, puppy. I love you, puppy. I love you, love you, love you, puppy. Yeah, that's my puppy. I love you, love you, love you, puppy.
Pop star Jennifer Lopez has a new album on the way in June, and she recently dropped her first music video from that new record. It's for this song called I Love Ya Papi, and it's the latest example of a music video that's got a point to make about gender stereotypes in the music industry. Writer Daisy Buchanan recently wrote about the video for the British publication The Telegraph, and she's Skyping in to our Soundcheck studios from London. Hi, Daisy.
Hello.
So for people who haven't seen J-Lo's video, can you explain what she's attempting to do here?
It starts very explicitly with, I don't know if I can call her J-Lo, I don't know her, J-Lo, Jennifer, but she's sat on the sofa with her dancers and she's with the director, he's a guy.
So, Jen, we have some great treatments for your next music video.
Okay.
Remember, this is your 10th album.
Wow. Yay!
I'm really excited.
Exciting.
And, you know, keep in mind, we got to get this first video right.
Yes.
First single, I Love You, Papi. It's so warm and fuzzy. We were thinking we shoot at someplace fun, colorful, maybe a water park.
A water park.
And it's all quite cute and sweet, and let's go to the zoo. Let's do it at Carnival. And her dancers say,
if she was a guy, we wouldn't be having this conversation at oil.
No, seriously, because if she was a dude, they would seriously have her up in a mansion with all these half-naked girls, or maybe even in that yacht. You know how they stay doing a yacht scene
right.
With champagne?
See, though, like, why do men always objectify the women in every single video? Like, why can't we for once objectify the men?
True.
And you know, I think it's totally true, and it's really interesting to hear that sentiment coming from people near J-Lo, you know, because for like I guess 10 years she's been part of that industry, and you know, in the videos with the sexy lady dancers and sort of the party to that. So it's, you know, not like a sort of a new artist coming and being controversial. She's really kind of well positioned to execute that flip and make the observation as well.
So she's not only attempting to make that flip, but attempting to tell us that this is what she is about to do. Do you think the message is clear once the preamble stops and the actual music video starts?
It is a little shaky in places. There are definitely contradictions within the video, and I think that's fine. You know, I think it's too much to ask that, you know, everything is completely fixed within this one video. I think that her fans need to kind of recognize her, and they would be alienated if it was, you know, such a dramatic about turn that it, you know, wasn't kind of comparable to anything else she's done. I mean, so you see her in hot pants, you know, her and her dancers, they're not as naked as some of the guys, but they're in sexy outfits. You see the famous J-Lo derriere, I guess. Can I say derriere?
I think you just did.
And then I think it is French Montana, who's the rapper who is, you know, on the track at the end.
Right.
He wears the most clothes. You still have, it's him and the director at the beginning. They are still the only people who get to be fully clothed in this performance, which I think is quite telling.
South Bronx, Teter Burrow, just overseas. Take the pins out of here, drop to her knees. Oh my, I'm a don like Omar. Speed it up, slow my, throw it back, throw my. Rock, rock gators like my Detroit plays. You can hate the lovers, you can love the haters.
And then, you know, when he turns up, but J-Lo and her dancers are still making all these sexy moves. They look amazing. I think there's an element of twerking in places, but, you know, there's lots of kind of wiggling about, and it's not, you know, that dramatic a departure.
So it's more of a conversation starter than a serious move away from business as usual.
Absolutely. And I think what's quite nice about it is that it's quite playful and cheeky. I think that when we talk about these issues, there's a real risk that you can be too earnest and quite aggressive. And I think it's understandable that people are angry. I've seen some music videos that have made me incredibly angry. But I think J-Lo is smart enough to know that, you know, if she is too serious, people won't take her seriously, that she needs to give, you know, everyone a way in, basically.
Yeah, interesting way of putting it. You can find a link to Daisy Buchanan's piece about the new Jennifer Lopez video for I Love You, Poppy, on the website soundcheck.org. She wrote about it for The Telegraph over in the UK, and she's with us on Soundcheck. And this is just the latest video, Daisy, to be based on this premise of challenging business as usual. Tell us a little bit about the Lily Allen song, and more important, the video for the song, Heart Out Here.
Again, that starts with a fairly clear, explicit message where she's talking about, you know, executives kind of suggesting that she has surgery to change herself and her body and become more presentable. And they talk about how the video is going to be in that sort of traditional hypersexual setup with lots of, you know, dancers shaking their booties. There was a massive, quite negative reaction to that in the UK because a problem, you know, Lily is a white lady dancing around. She remains clothed in the video, but her backing dancers are mainly women of color. Mm-hmm. You don't often see their faces. You know, there's lots of kind of focuses on, you know, their separated body parts, and, you know, they are, you know, sort of grinding and shaking, and, you know, they're not given a narrative. They're just sort of in there supporting it. And I think what Lily was trying to do was make a point that that is often how women are presented, and she wanted to send up the absurdity and awfulness of that. But I think in a way it was perhaps a bit too bold and a bit problematic. And I think that no matter what the maker's intention is, if something is offending groups and sort of clearly offensive and a bit worrying, you've got to, you know, go back and rethink and think maybe, again, you know, I tried to start a conversation, but it didn't quite go the way I hoped, and I need to go back to the drawing board.
Right. So the video starts with Lily Allen, you know, she's on the table getting liposuction because, you know, well, how does a woman let herself go like that? Well, I had two kids. And then, you know, so she's being told that she needs to get it together for her next round of songs and videos. And this is the song and the video that follows called Heart Out Here.
I suppose I should tell you what this bitch is thinking. You could
Lily Allen and Hard Out Here. She sings, "Don't need to shake my ass for you because I've got a brain," so that message is clear. But as Daisy Buchanan was just telling us, kind of a mixed message in the video, because there are all these scantily clad women of color, and they're, you know, doing the usual twerking and approaching twerking stuff that we see in so many of these music videos, Daisy. This is all happening on the heels of a lot of pretty well-publicized incidents, Miley Cyrus at the VMAs and Robin Thicke's Blurred Lines video. Why is this all happening right now, do you think?
It does feel like 2013 was this tipping point for it, that it was slowly getting more and more and more exaggerated and ridiculous. Like the other day, I was in the gym and they played an old Rihanna video, and I remember thinking, I can't remember the last time I saw Rihanna wearing so many clothes. And, you know, it's from, I guess, maybe, I can't remember what it was, but it's sort of 2008, 2009. I thought, yeah, everyone's just slowly been, you know, stripping, losing clothes over the years. And it's been gradual enough for us not to notice. And then I think last year it got so extreme, everyone reeled and thought, you know, what is this? This has got to stop. I mean, I do think, and it's, you know, pop is a broad genre and there are lots of amazing women doing amazing different records. Like, I love artists like Chaim and Lord, who, you know, those women, they're keeping their clothes on and they're not saying, "Hey, look at me, I've got my clothes on." They're just getting on with it and making really great records that people love. And I think that, you know, young women are interested in, you know, women like those guys, and the number of role models they have is kind of, that's increasing. It's not just kind of the only people who are out there doing it are the people who are getting naked. Like, I mean, I'm a big Lady Gaga fan and I love the way she uses her body. And although she's very sexual, it's quite artistic and dramatic and threatening and very different from the way that a lot of other artists do.
You know, one of the things with Gaga is, you know, whatever she does, you get the impression, as you did earlier with Madonna, that she at least is calling the shots. If she's,
yes, exactly.
You know. In the long run, Daisy, do you think that these videos by J-Lo and Lily Allen, however mixed the message is, do you think that the attempt that they're making will bear fruit over the years? Or is it more important to go the route that you mentioned Haim and Lord are taking, which is just getting on with it and not playing the game as it's usually played and just doing what they do? Which do you think, or do you need both?
I think you definitely need both. I think all these women's voices are incredibly important, and that after, you know, Miley and Robin Thicke and everything that's been happening in the industry for the last few years, if everyone just put their clothes on and got on with it, you know, I think that would be too much of a shock and there'd be too much of a gap. And you need the different sides to kind of contribute to the discussion. As you said earlier, it's starting a conversation and, you know, making people talk it out. And that will make people think about what they want rather than just, you know, seeing these videos and, you know, going along with it and not really being conscious of the change. I mean, I think, and I mentioned in my article, J-Lo is a really interesting example because she's an artist that everyone is aware of. Like, you might have to be a proper music fan to know about Lorde and to go to her gigs and buy her records. But, you know, you might not have bought any music for years, but you will still know about J-Lo and you'll still recognise a J-Lo song. So to have people like that taking up the cause, as well as the newer artists that, you know, music fans respond to, I think is vital.
Well, you can find a link to Daisy Buchanan's piece about Jennifer Lopez's new video, a piece she wrote for The Telegraph. It's on our website now at soundcheck.org. Daisy's a writer and columnist for various publications, including The Telegraph and The Guardian. She's been talking with us via Skype from London. And Daisy, thanks very much for being with us on Soundcheck.
Thanks for having me, John.
Easy. Easy.
That's a little bit of Lorde's latest release. It's a collaboration with the New York-based alternative classical musician and songwriter Sun Lux, a song called Easy. Up next, we're bringing you some highlights from this year's South by Southwest Music Festival in Austin, Texas. Singer-songwriter Khalees, who you might know from her mega-hit Milkshake, performed at the NPR Music Showcase, and she gave listeners a sneak preview of her upcoming album, which drops next month. In a moment, we'll take a listen. Stay with us. This is Soundcheck.
My milkshake brings all the boys to the yard, and they're like, it's better than yours. Damn right, it's better than yours. I could teach you, but I have to charge. My milkshake brings all the boys to the yard. And
this is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Singer-songwriter Khalees broke into the pop world in a major way when she released her 2003 album Tasty. It featured the Neptunes-produced song Milkshake, which not only became a top 10 hit, but also turned an innocent dessert into a euphemism for something else entirely. Khalees put out a dance-pop album called Flesh Tone in 2010, and since then hadn't performed here in the States at all, until the NPR Music Showcase at South by Southwest last week. Her set was mainly a preview of her upcoming album called Food. Khalees is, by the way, a chef now as well as a singer. Anyway, Food is a soulful reinvention produced by TV on the Radio's Dave Sitek. But rather than kicking off her set with a new song, Khalees, who brought along a 12-piece band, started the set with a tribute to the high priestess of soul herself, Nina Simone.
Flying high, you know how I feel. Sun in the sky, you know how I feel. Breeze drifting on by, you know how I feel. It's a new dawn, it's a new day, it's a new light. It's a new dawn, it's a new day. It's a new life for me.
This is my first time here to South By, so I'm actually very excited. I'm taller than I thought I was.
Hey guys. Are you hungry? My mom
I wanna say thank you.
That's Khalees with a live version of her song Breakfast, and you can watch a video of what you just heard at soundcheck.org. That's just one song off Khalees's upcoming album called Food, from this singer, songwriter, and chef. Maybe it's not a huge surprise that this album contains several songs that sound like they could end up on your table. There's Cobbler, Friday Fish Fry, Biscuits and Gravy, and this next one called Jerk Ribs. This is Khalees, performing at the NPR Music Showcase at South by Southwest.
We'll be right back.
That's Khalees, live at the NPR Music Showcase at the South by Southwest Music Festival last week in Austin, Texas. You can hear her entire set, which includes several more songs from her upcoming album, Food, as well as a couple of old favorites and Nina Simone tributes, at soundcheck.org. Speaking of Nina Simone, up next we'll talk about Nina Simone's contributions to the civil rights movement with author Ruth Feldstein. That's next on Soundcheck. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Fans of the late singer Nina Simone often didn't know what to make of her. She could seem remote or lovable or out-and-out hostile, but her talent and contributions to music and to the struggle for civil rights are indisputable. Joining me in the studio is historian Ruth Feldstein, whose latest book is called How It Feels to Be Free: Black Women Entertainers and the Civil Rights Movement. Ruth, welcome to Soundcheck.
Thank you so much.
You know, the way we view Nina Simone now, sort of associating her with the civil rights movement, doesn't seem to... That's kind of a new way of approaching Nina Simone, isn't it?
I think it is, yes. At the time when she was making a name for herself, she was enormously popular and enormously controversial, too. She had a huge range of songs, so she wrote about everything ranging from the death of Martin Luther King to Beatles songs to folk songs. But when I first started doing research on Nina Simone, people involved in the movement and people who had been activists certainly remembered her and remembered her songs as anthems, but I think a lot of people, when they think about music and the civil rights movement, they think about We Shall Overcome.
Right.
They think about This Little Light of Mine.
Mm-hmm.
When I go to my kids'
Eyes on
assemblies
the prize and, yeah.
for Martin Luther King Day, these are the songs that are
right.
playing. And as a result of how dominant that association is in terms of civil rights music to those kind of freedom songs, other kinds of music have tended to fall off the radar.
Right. So Nina Simone wasn't considered to have written freedom songs per se.
Right.
In fact, my understanding was, you know, here was this woman from the South who had some classical training and who really felt that that was her sort of intended path and that she kind of got pulled in all these other directions. In your research,
right.
does that is get
exactly,
borne out?
Exactly. Simone was born in 1933 in a small town in North Carolina, and she started playing the piano at a very young age. By the time she was 3 years old, Her mother did domestic work. Her father was mostly a handyman.
How did she have access to a piano?
The town came together, whites and blacks, in this rural southern town, and did fundraising for her to be able to afford piano lessons. So she was classically trained. When she was a teenager, she ended up at Juilliard for a year, and she really hoped to go to the very prestigious Curtis Institute in Philadelphia. Mm-hmm. She didn't get in 1951, which was devastating to her. At that point, she stayed in Philadelphia. She continued her own classical training, but she needed money to, you know, to support herself and for her own lessons. So she started playing the piano at an Atlantic City nightclub. And then, under pressure from her first boss, started singing and eventually starting to write her own songs. And by 1958, she had had her first hit.
With
I Love You, Porgy.
I love you, Porgy. Don't let them take me. Don't let him handle me and drive me mad. If you can keep me, I wanna stay with you forever. Yes, I love you, Porgy. Don't let him take me. Don't let him handle me with his hot hands. If you can keep me, I want to stay here with you forever. I've got my man.
Just a little bit of I Loves You, Porgy, released by Nina Simone in 1958. We're talking about the singer, songwriter, and pianist with historian Ruth Feldstein, who teaches at Rutgers. Her book is called How It Feels to Be Free. The story of, you know, a young woman making her way in the music business and her boss insists that she starts singing instead of, you know, what she wanted to do, which was simply play the piano. We've heard that so often, but my goodness, it worked out so well, didn't it?
Well, I think this song and her background in general really matters, because this song really launched her commercial career. But I think from the outset, you can see, even before she is writing explicitly political songs, that Simone was defying categories. She really blended jazz with blues, with gospel, with classical, the classical training that she'd received. She had a very, very eclectic repertoire.
And here, George Gershwin did the same thing, you know, with Porgy and Bess.
And people loved her, and they called her this hot new thing, and she was the sensation, and she was sort of the it girl of the moment, but they didn't know how to define her. Mm-hmm. So that from the start, again, she was posing challenges to these conventional cultural categories, and I think that in some way she was poised then to also defy and pose challenges politically, which she did increasingly by 1963.
Now, what's the turning point? The turning point happens in 63, doesn't it?
The turning point happens in 1963. What she calls her first civil rights song was the song Mississippi Goddamn, which she writes in September of 1963. She has just heard about the church bombing in Birmingham, Alabama, in which four young girls were killed. And she said later that the song, I forget the exact quote, the song exploded out of her with rage and fury. And it's an incredible song in many ways, lyrically, musically, politically. She contrasts this very rollicking, upbeat rhythm with these lyrics that are just filled with rage and despair a month after the March on Washington, that moment that people think of as the heyday of interracial liberalism and this beautiful moment of solidarity in the civil rights movement. A month later, she is challenging interracial activism. She is challenging a church-based movement that emphasized nonviolence. Mm-hmm. She is challenging assumptions that prejudice and discrimination were Southern phenomenon. So she is really articulating a different kind of political vision than that which many people today think of as being associated with that phase of the civil rights movement.
So when we look back on the civil rights movement, we sort of, in hindsight, have kind of sloughed off the things at the edges and looked kind of at the main, what the media has shown us over the years. But there at one edge was Nina Simone. Is it true that her first reaction to the church bombing was, I'm going to get a gun, right, and that the song was her second,
right,
perhaps more measured response?
Right. Her husband at the time was a police officer. And so that's, so she said, you know, there were guns, there were materials around the house. And then she said, or she later said, I don't know anything about guns, but I know about music. Mm-hmm. So, and again, those ideas are at the heart of Black Power and are at the heart of the Black Arts Movement, that politically relevant culture is central to Black politics and Black activism. And many scholars today in the last decade have shown that the civil rights movement is not this neat divide between interracial activism in the early 60s and Black Power in the late 60s. But I still think it's very hard to get past that image of Black Power as being associated with the later period and as being associated with Black men in leather jackets,
right,
you know, with their fists up or holding a gun. And here she is in 1963 expressing these ideas.
A woman, an entertainer, not in a leather jacket, but often in a very
long gown.
Mm-hmm. Nina Simone is who we're talking about with the historian Ruth Feldstein. And here is that song from 1963. This recording made the next year in concert, Nina Simone's Mississippi Goddamn.
The name of this tune is Mississippi Goddamn. I mean every word of it. Alabama's got me so upset. Tennessee made me lose my rest. And everybody knows about Mississippi. Goddamn! Alabama's got me so upset. Tennessee made me lose my rest. And everybody knows about Mississippi. It's all in the air. I can't stand the pressure much longer. Somebody say a prayer. Alabama's gotten me so upset. Tennessee made me lose my rest. And everybody knows about Mississippi. Goddamn! This is a show tune, but the show hasn't been written for it yet.
Nina Simone recorded in concert 1964 with a version of her first civil rights song, as she called it, Mississippi Goddamn. And we are talking with the historian Ruth Feldstein. Her book is called How It Feels to Be Free, Black Women Entertainers and the Civil Rights Movement. So it's 5 years between her first appearance on the scene with the hit version of I Love You Porgy, the George Gershwin song, and then writing Mississippi Goddamn. Was she... Do you think, Ruth, she was a reluctant kind of icon of the civil rights movement? Did she make her peace with it at some point?
I don't think she ever made her peace with much in her life. That's not a quality I would associate with her. I think that she felt compelled to do this. Mm-hmm. And one of the people who made her feel that way and made her think much more about politics was her very good friend Lorraine Hansberry. Hansberry was a playwright whose hit play, Raisin in the Sun, had come out a few years earlier, and they were close friends. And Simone explained repeatedly that Hansberry was the person who took her out of herself and made her think about the big picture, about class relations in this country, about race relations in this country. And I think that that's a very important part of Simone's story, because I think it's a link in terms of understanding how important gender was to her Black politics. In song after song after song, in many, many different ways, she made the power of Black women central to her vision of Black liberation.
Mm-hmm.
So not only was she different in 1963 in terms of articulating a Black power perspective, not that she was alone by any means, but... You know, it wasn't what people associate as the mainstream, but she also stood out because her vision of Black Power was Black Power that was free of misogyny and that, again, claimed power for black women. And we see this in Mississippi Goddam, not in the clip that we just listened to, but there's a line where she is rejecting the idea that black women have to behave in a certain way, be respectable, be ladylike to deserve equal treatment and full rights. And she's saying, no, that's not going to work anymore. Hmm. Her performance of rage on that song is itself a rejection of that idea.
But rage, but also with this kind of sardonic humor,
right,
as well.
Exactly. The laughter of the audience is very interesting.
It's kind of a nervous laughter,
yes,
isn't
exactly,
it?
Exactly, exactly. And the idea of calling this a show tune, but the show hasn't been written yet, there are layers of threat, I think, even though people also feel that she was such a mesmerizing performer and made such a magical connection to her audiences, there's a certain kind of discomfort at the same time. And I think that's because there was this assumption that black women, again, should behave a certain way if they were going to be claiming rights.
Now, before Nina Simone, you know, you had Marian Anderson, the great contralto, classically trained, and because she was black, you know, denied access to some of the biggest stages in this country, although she had a good career in Europe, and who, you know, really when portrayed herself as a lady, you know, very elegant, very classical. At some point, when Nina Simone sort of grasps onto both the racial and especially the gender roles and the gender wars, she begins to change her appearance, doesn't she?
She changes her appearance. She becomes, she is wearing clothing and hairstyles more associated with black cultural nationalism and with Africa specifically. She wears her hair more often natural, Afro, though, again, she moves between lots of different styles. She performs with musicians from Africa as well. But I think it's important to see with Simone is that, again, she's always blending things and always doing a lot of things at once. So she never discarded the respectability that was associated with being a classically trained musician. She just also said at the same time she could express this rage. She could use other kinds of styles. She could use her body to show herself as an empowered black woman performer, both on stage and off stage.
And was she, though? Was she empowered? I mean, did she at some point take control of her career and do the things she wanted?
Well, sadly, in her own personal life, that was not the case. But I think that in terms of her political activism and the contributions she made politically through her music, control and that assertion of power were central for her.
And so it came out in these kind of angry songs that she would write, in the kind of jokes she would tell.
Humor, I think, is important. I'm sorry, yes.
And then there's the song Go Limp, which is, this is kind of her shot across the bow in the both looking at the nonviolence that was kind of the mainstream of the civil rights movement, looking at it with kind of a, you know, sidelong glance, and perhaps a little dig at the ongoing gender thing as well.
Right. It's a very funny song, too, which, again, stands in such contrast to a song like Mississippi Goddam or another song on that album, Pirate Jenny, which is so full of rage and is a black woman's fantasy of violence, violent revenge, whereas Go Limp is a spoof of the sexual politics of nonviolent protesters, a spoof of folk music as a genre. So again, her playing with different kinds of musical genres and really questioning the idea of restraint, both in terms of politically, in terms of civil rights activism and self-restraint and nonviolence, and in terms of this emphasis that black women should show a certain kind of sexual self-restraint and really acknowledging black women's sexual desires as well.
So the song's called Go Limp. And it's another from the late Nina Simone, one of the subjects of Ruth Feldstein's book, How It Feels to Be Free, Black Women Entertainers and the Civil Rights Movement.
Daughter, dear daughter, take warning from me, and don't you go marching with the NAACP. For they'll rock you and roll you and shove you into bed. And if they steal your nuclear secrets, you'll wish you were dead. singing to relax, to relax, to relax. You get the gist of the song now? When we get to the chorus again, I expect you to sing with us. Oh, mother, dear mother, no, I'm not afraid. For I'll go on that march, and I'll return a virgin maid. With a brick in my handbag and a smile on my face, and barbed wire in my underwear to shed off disgrace.
The song Go Limp, the familiar folk melody that many kids sang in assembly back in the 60s, and here with words that you would not necessarily find kids singing in assembly.
I can't listen to that song without laughing.
It's
no matter
funny.
How many times I hear it. And just this whole question of who or what is going to go limp remains unanswered. Which,
although, despite her early protests in the song that she will come back a virgin maid and the barbed wire and the underpants, she actually comes back
exactly
with a kid.
Right, right.
And not a husband. So there's, again, this kind of acknowledgement of desire and lust, but also of, you know, I can do this
exactly
by myself if you're not going to help.
And at the same time, spoofing this very masculine emphasis within a lot of civil rights activism on this macho posturing by telling the story from the point of view of the woman in the story.
Mm-hmm.
So
now let me, your book's subtitle is Black Women Entertainers, Plural, and the Civil Rights Movement. Mm-hmm. So it's not just Nina Simone.
No.
Who else is in this circle?
The cast that I'm focusing on in the book includes Lena Horne, Simone, Mary Makeba, who's a South African woman who spent 10 years in the United States from 1958 to 1968. Abby Lincoln, jazz singer, but also was in several films, and I focus on her film career. Diane Carroll and Cecily Tyson.
Mm-hmm.
So the book goes from 1943, Lena Horne's movie Cabin in the Sky, to Roots in 1976, in which Cecily Tyson had a small but important part.
Right. And Miriam Makeba, who spent a number of years here in New York, you know, was very important on the folk music, the Greenwich Village circuit, you know, very much lionized by people like a young Bob Dylan and that whole crowd.
Right.
So that there were sort of numerous
intersections.
Yeah.
Right. The group that I focus on, this is not a sisterhood by any means, but they were a loosely connected cohort. They had a lot of overlapping circles and friends and acquaintances, and they themselves worked together and collaborated in certain instances. And they had shared sets of concerns. They all took risks when they made the choice to support the civil rights movement and black activism in their careers as entertainers, even though they did that in very, very different ways. But I think the other thing that unites them is, as I said with Simone, for all of them, gender was an important part of the kind of black freedom that they wanted.
Mm-hmm. Well, if it's civil rights, women deserve those civil rights as much as, you know, African Americans.
Right.
So
yeah, exactly.
I guess it was sort of a broader view of what civil rights could mean.
Mm-hmm.
So when she wrote a song like For Women,
would
she have had this kind of loose connection to other women, you know, in her mind?
Yes. For Women is a song that she wrote in 66, and it tells the story of four types. She takes up common stereotypes that circulated in mainstream American culture, the mammy, very subordinate, very overworked, very asexual. She takes up the type of a more sort of sexualized Jezebel and other sort of archetypes of black women, and she gives these women a voice, and she tells their story, and she expresses their pain, and she expresses their history, and she rejects this degradation of black women's bodies, of black women's beauty. She also attends to issues of color consciousness within black communities that many women at the time were experiencing. And she later said she wrote it because this is what was going on in all black women's minds all the time.
Mm.
And that's who she wrote it for, even though it became one of her most popular songs in the late 60s. And I think when you listen to a clip of it, it's almost like consciousness raising in song, even though, again, Simone herself did not identify with a women's liberation movement that she associated with white women. Mm. Yet you see a lot of the same kinds of arguments and themes that, again, became very important to black feminism as it really flourished in the 70s.
Well, let's hear a little bit of Four Women from the late Nina Simone as we wrap up here with Ruth Feldstein, who teaches at Rutgers. Her book is out now. It's called How It Feels to Be Free, Black Women Entertainers and the Civil Rights Movement. And Ruth, this has been a fascinating look back at the late Nina Simone. Thank you.
My skin is black. My arms are long. My hair is woolly. My back is strong. Strong enough to take the pain inflicted again and again. What do they call me? My name is Aunt Sarah.
Before we wrap up for today, I want to play you one more song. It's the new single off the forthcoming record by Tune Yards. The record will be called Nicky Knack. In case you're not familiar with Tune Yards, it's basically the work of a singer-songwriter and multi-instrumentalist named Merrill Garbus. Her debut album as Tune Yards was a big hit in the indie pop world back in 2011. It was called Who Kill? And you can hear a performance that she did for us a couple of years ago at soundcheck.org. While you're there, you can read our knee-jerk reactions to this new song from Tune Yards. It's called Water Fountain. A song called Water Fountain off of the upcoming album by Tune Yards. It's due out in May. Tell us what you thought about it and read our knee-jerk reactions to this single at soundcheck.org. All next week on the show, we'll examine the past 100 years of New York music in collaboration with New York Magazine and their annual Nostalgia issue. As we take a fond decade-by-decade look back, we want to know, what decade in New York music are you nostalgic for? Call us up and leave a voicemail at 866-939-1612. That's 866-939-1612. Or email us, soundcheck@wnyc.org. Also, Monday, live music from The Stripes, a power blues and rock quartet from Cavan, Ireland. They recently toured with the Arctic Monkeys, and Jeff Beck and Noel Gallagher are fans. You might be too, after you hear them live. Soundcheck is a production of WNYC. Irene Trudell leads our engineering team with Paul Schneider, Bill O'Neill, and Jason Isaac. The show is produced by Katie Bishop, Dan O'Donnell, and Mike Katziff, with help from Amy Pearl and our intern Ryan Kyloff. Our executive producer is Joel Meyer. I'm John Schaefer. This is Soundcheck.